Hi, Darren. Great to have you joining us.
Thank you very much. Very nice and exciting to be talking about this project.
Right. The snow leopard scene. I want to look at that in a lot of detail because it was absolutely striking. It was one of those things that I feel has stayed with me most after watching the series. So snow leopards, they are notoriously one of the most difficult animals in the world to film. So is this an assignment that you were given? Someone came up to you and were like, you know what? Go out there, try and do this, the hardest scene you could possibly shoot. Or did you push for it yourself?
Well, the snow leopard scene itself was obviously, it was something we wanted to have because we wanted to have to show an animal in an extreme environment and one that's charismatic. So from the off, there was no greater contender than the snow leopard living at crazy altitudes in the Himalayas. And luckily what comes with the territory of snow leopards is you get the ibex and the blue sheep as well. So it's a bigger mammal story than just the snow leopards themselves. But Adam, the producer, was very keen on it, and it didn't take much of a sell for me to go and film one of the, it's probably the bucket list species. I think any wildlife filmmaker would jump at the chance to spend 7 weeks filming snow leopards. And I was just the lucky recipient of this job. I'll just put it that way. I was very happy to take this one.
Well, I bet. So had you ever done anything like this before? Like, how optimistic were you that you could get this done?
Well, as with all natural history sequences, you have to give yourself time. So we had allowed seven weeks, roughly. I think it was 35 filming days in total. And that obviously gives you a level of optimism that would, if you had 35 filming days with lions, you would know you were coming back with something good because you just know that lions will deliver because they're in, say, the Serengeti, they're on the plains and you can access them. You drive up to them very easily and smoothly in your vehicle and you can spend all day with them. But these weren't lions. And so we needed every single one of those 35 days out in the field with them because they're in the most crazy habitats. It's challenging not only for them, it's challenging for us and them, but the challenge itself is getting eyes on these animals, and they are incredibly difficult to spot. And I think that's ultimately the biggest challenge. And the reason we were left with some optimism for this shoot was because a location in India had become a real hotspot for snow leopard sightings. It was all led by some NGOs in the area who started to see the benefit of protecting snow leopards. And through years and years and years of protecting the snow leopards in the community and the area, they installed a community insurance policy where if a snow leopard took any of the local mountain sheep that the people who lived up in the mountains and area that they kept, they would get insured against that. So there was no kind of, it all started with the snow leopard had one less threat to deal with, which was the humans. They were allowed to then have space, have flourish, take the odd sheep that they were very, if they were desperate enough, they would take the local sheep. But now that they weren't being persecuted for that, so that behavior was being tolerated, and essentially this location became more and more of a safe place for snow leopards to go about their lives. And when you start protecting the apex predators in these locations, then everything benefits. So this area in India, in the Spiti Valley, just became an amazing place for the prey species. So you had a huge amount of ibex and blue sheep. And then with the ibex and the blue sheep come the snow leopards. And so we were really, really confident from the intel we had from the location that these snow leopards were there. They were not scared of humans in maybe the way they have been in the past. Farmers were no longer concerned or chasing them or chasing them off their land, and ultimately a snow leopard generation had been born that were no longer fearing humans. So that was one massive, massive benefit. And one of the things that just gave us optimism, we had time on our hands. We had a location where the species was known and a species that would tolerate the presence of people. And in our case, a camera crew looking to get the shots to make this amazing sequence.
Right. Can you take us from Silverback office in Bristol in the United Kingdom? Can you take us and your camera crew to the Himalayas? So how much equipment did you take? And I guess were the logistics of getting everything there actually harder than getting the footage?
Often the logistics are challenging. They're challenging for whenever you take camera equipment around the world. But the logistics for taking it to extremely cold temperatures, high altitude, and extremely hostile environment just adds another layer. And then obviously the equipment you choose to film and capture amazing footage with these elusive animals, you have to cast your net wide. So one of the, as well as having traditional long lens techniques, something we wanted to take out with us were camera traps. And they took up one of the largest amounts of our luggage. So we had, I think, 8 dedicated cases alone just for the camera trap equipment. So we're leaving the UK with 35 bags and just two crew. John H. himself and as camera operator, and then myself as the field director. So just two of us lugging all this equipment, starting in Bristol, looking at it, standing back and going, I think we've got everything we need, to then getting on, getting it all loaded, and then starting our long, long journey into the Himalayas.
Did you have to pay extra for baggage?
Yeah, well, baggage, it's always a perennial problem for film crews. And but this is, it's a bit of an extra lump sum when it comes to taking that much equipment. But this is what we needed, and this is what we needed to take with us to bring home the footage we did manage to capture. So so there's John and I with 35 bags at check-in, waiting at the British Airways desk at Heathrow, and then we have that nice moment where you get to pass it over onto the conveyor belt, and then it disappears, and you don't have to worry about it for at least 10 hours until the other end. And then we have the chaotic experience of landing in Delhi, where you're met with chaos unlike any other airport I've experienced. And there we met our local fixers and guides who were going to take us up into the Himalaya. And then I was just in a flood of me, John, 35 bags going in all different directions. But that was the first challenge, was navigating our way. It can't have been more than 200 meters from the arrivals at Delhi to get across the car park to load up, to get ourselves up into the mountains. But that was a fun start. But I think that was a taste of what was to come of this adventure.
Okay. My own snow leopard has just joined me on my desk. I'm going to have to get rid of him, otherwise he's going to purr into the microphone like a pest.
Oh, I can hear that. Yeah, it's fab. What a lovely sound. I wish I'd got that close to hear a snow leopard purr. Tried our best.
Are they purring cats, or are they roaring cats?
I'm not sure. They call, but I don't think that. I think they're a purring cat. I think they.
Oh.
The calls are very, very distinct, but it's more of a laboured meow, gruffy meow, rather than a roar. I don't think they're roarers, these guys.
Right.
I have to double check that.
You're on the record now.
Oh, no. But I definitely heard the noise they do make.
So you're in the right area now. You've managed to get your 35 bags into the Himalayas. You set up shop. How difficult is it going to be to spot a snow leopard? I mean, they're exceptionally well camouflaged, aren't they? There were times watching this scene where, you know, like I look away for a moment from the screen, look back, and I've lost them. Can't find them. Takes a moment for my eyes to readjust to where they were. They're so well camouflaged.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty much the story of our entire trip. As I said before, spending time with other big cats in other parts of the world, in Africa, you kind of, by the end of your three-week trip, you feel like you could be a guide yourself. You're just spotting everything. You can see the slightest move on the horizon. You really get your eye in. But snow leopards, I didn't leave being a snow leopard spotting expert. And to this day, I just don't know how our guides, I literally just don't know how they do it, because one of my take homes from the trip was the fact that these cats have the wrong name. They are rock cats. They are rock cats because they blend into the stony hillside. They melt. They simply just melt into it and you cannot see them. Well, obviously you can, someone can see them, but us mere mortals couldn't. But our guide, Tenzing Dorje was his name. He had this incredible ability to just focus in and just spot the most subtle of details. They are extraordinary. I mean, the camouflage, like all animals that have the ability to blend in, but this mammal, this snow leopard, was just, it was made, its coat was just purely perfect for blending in to the hillside. And I think that's generally, I think, the reason they tend to hunt on these south-facing cliff sides. That was always where the prey was. They tend to be these very steep, scree slopes that don't hold the snow, and they're perfectly angled, even in the depths of winter. They're perfectly angled for the sun just to constantly just melt the layer of snow that does settle onto it. So it reveals this just pebbly, scree, grey, mottled, stony cliff. And that is the colour of the snow leopards. This is where they hunt. This is where they hide. And this is how they creep up on their prey. They're extraordinary. They're the hardest. Until they moved, I'd lose them. Like you said, I would just look away for a second, have a little sip of chai, and then you turn your head back and you've lost them. And then you spend the next 10 minutes trying to remember where they were, or you give the guide a little bit of a nudge and say, "Hey, can you point this expensive camera at where that snow leopard we're trying to film is? Because I've lost it."
How far away did you have to be? Is it like 500 meters or?
Well, no. I think most of the time we spent, probably on average, we probably spent our time 300 to. Maybe 200 was the closest we would get to them. For the majority of the filming, we would get 200 meters the closest, then anything up to 500 meters, because they, like I said, they spend all their time on the south-facing slopes. And in order to film them, you kind of have to, or to spot them at least, you have to be on the opposite side of this gorge. So that ultimately sets you, you're kind of defined then by the width of that gorge. And then you decide based on the prey, it's like, well, do we go down the gorge a little bit? Or do we go up the, that's where your kind of field craft comes in. You kind of decide in which direction they may begin to stalk the ibex. But we spent a lot of the time quite a long way away until we got the opening shots of the sequence, which was the male who had taken down an ibex that had gone and fallen into the bottom of the valley, and he was tucking into this ibex on the river. We were able to get a hide into position there, and that, I think, got us down to about 35, 50 meters. So,
Ooh. So
that was the closest we got to the snow leopard, but they're so elusive. You never know. There could be one, could have been moments where they were just around the corner, but you just don't know. And it's a really, really difficult environment to film in, because for 90% of the time you're working with a 2D wall, a little bit like a Snakes and Ladders. You're just kind of staring at this place, and everything's playing out on this 2D plane, up, down, left, right. But then that game can completely change. If they decided for whatever reason to change Valleyside, all of a sudden they're on the same side as you, and then they're coming towards you and going away from you. So, it's a very challenging environment to film in. John did an amazing job.
How frequently did you see them? Were you waiting half a day between snow leopards coming through, or was it like a snow leopard superhighway buffet where they were coming like every 10 minutes for food?
Definitely not a superhighway, but probably a superhighway by snow leopard sighting standards. So we would spend, I think, like I said, I've got my field notes buried somewhere in my basement, but I think 35 filming days, I think it was around about 28 days that we had a sighting. There was one to see, whether that was a fleeting kind of, it's there, then we lose it. I think that was roughly the hit rate, but some days were more fruitful than others. Like I said, some days we'd be able to sit from morning till evening with the cats. Other days we'd maybe see them for 10 minutes. And to be honest with you, the best technique for us was we'd sit in our mud-walled homestay in the village of Kibber, and we'd sit there, and our guide would head out. We had two main spotters who would kind of try to cover different areas of the valley, and we'd wait for them to call it in, because the problem was, if we were to commit, I mean, the cats move, they're never predictable. You can't know where they are the following day. You can't leave them one place and expect to find them there the following morning. So it was the best choice for us was to let the spotters find them, and then we would hike in, because we'd have to hike in anything up to 6 and 7 kilometers with two cameras, two tripods, two massive tripod heads, which is an exhausting effort. So I think we kind of came down with the best plan of not committing until we had the sighting. And that was what allowed us to be reactive, even up until the very, very last moment of the shoot.
So with something so elusive, I mean, you've got days where you haven't seen a snow leopard. There's a lot of pressure to get the shot right. So did you have a lot of frustration in that you'd get near misses, you'd turn up and there wouldn't be anything there, or there'd be a scene that would be fantastic and like a predation attempt, but you didn't have it perfectly in focus or perfectly in the center of the screen? So how many near misses and imperfect shots?
I think that'd probably be the story again of 90%, or maybe more than that, 95% of the material we capture. It's really tricky, because what you experience when you're over there filming, like I said, we filmed a lot of the time across this valley, and there's quite a big temperature gradient between the air that you're sitting in and then the warm air on the other side where the snow leopards are. So we always tended to be on the cold side, freezing, whilst the snow leopards were using the lovely warm side. And what happens is you get crazy, crazy heat haze, which interestingly can just turn your footage. It makes it look like it's underwater all of a sudden, or that there's a river flowing past. So then we had enormous moments. We're like, oh, this is gorgeous stuff. We just hope that this just dies off, this heat haze dies off. And it would, a kind of a gust of wind would come and it would push off that warm air that had gathered across the rocks. So this was happening quite regularly. And then things would take place and they would be at awkward angles, or you couldn't risk moving the camera, and then they would just go behind next part of the cliff. So John and I would try our best to almost leapfrog. So John would be operating the main camera, and then I would have a secondary camera, almost like a backup shot. And we'd try to kind of leapfrog. If the animals were moving in a direction that was going to evade our ability to film them, I would try and move ahead and then when we think the behaviors kind of just calmed down for a moment, then John would leapfrog across and he would try and get, I don't know, 100 meters, 200 meters further down the valley. So it's a constant game of just trying to get yourself in the best position in the most awkward, difficult, and challenging environment on the planet.
So we see a single old male and stick with him for an eventful few days or something. In documentaries, sometimes you will get a story that's made out of a composite of different animals. I think that is maybe a known secret of the industry, perhaps.
Yeah.
Was this male just the one male? Do we follow it all the way through?
We do, and that's the beauty of this location and this story is that this male that we followed. So just to give you the bigger picture of who the characters are in this scene, we had the mother and her three cubs, and then we have, oh, she's like a Disney princess. She's beautiful, fluffy. Her face is unblemished. She's got these three gorgeous cubs with her, and she's just great. She's the future. And then we have this male that he's a bit of a local hero over there because he's the male that they've been following. He's the male that kind of kicked off this amazing location's ability to guarantee snow leopard sightings. And the guys that have been following him, a lot of the guides have known this snow leopard for around about 10 years. So we think, we're not quite sure how old the male was. But it was, as you know, and maybe the listeners know if they've hopefully seen the scene by now, we get to witness the last 35 days of this snow leopard's life, which was kind of a massive honor, but also massively heartbreaking. To kind of answer your question, this is a single male. They were our characters. And this male, he was the first snow leopard we spotted when we first got there. He was really easy to spot and recognize because he kind of had a little bit of a limp. He wasn't moving as freely as he was when he was a little bit younger. And he had this very distinctive, almost chevron-shaped scar on its forehead. So we could spot it from a mile away. It's very distinctly different to the mother, who is lighter as well. So we knew who our characters were, and it was just a joy because we were able to, the spotters would go out and they're able just to send a quick note back saying, we're with the mother or we're with the male. So that was it. We just had our cast. And then over the time we established, he was the father of the cubs, and they had this amazing respectful behavior where they kind of kept out of each other's way. And there was one moment, sadly, we didn't get on camera because of the position we're in, where they briefly met the mother and the male, the old male. They met briefly during, and we were kind of thinking, oh my God, is this a moment we're going to miss where there's going to be some sort of some interaction where the male almost sees his own cubs as a threat to this territory now, as they're really successfully growing up in this mountain canyon. But to our delight, though it was a nice thing to see, it didn't. It was really, they met, they kind of saw each other from a distance, and they just peacefully just turned and went in different directions. So there was obviously some sort of known respect between these snow leopards as well. So yeah, from the very start of the filming, 35 days, we were with the same cats, and it was absolutely brilliant to be able to capture the fate of this old male. And he was full of character as an individual, because when we got the close-ups, when he was on the ibex, I think the ibex that we managed to film him on was his last meal. And it was really sad because he'd taken down this ibex, this huge, huge, huge animal. And through the worst bit of luck possible. This ibex kill that he'd taken down had landed in a river, and there was only maybe 10 to 20% of the ibex's body above the water, meaning that the snow leopard didn't really have that much to pick off. And so his last meal was the biggest effort, and he just couldn't get the food he needed for his strength. So it kind of played out that this, we were watching the last desperate days of this male whose teeth were ground down heavily. So you could see his teeth had really gone back almost to stumpy pegs in his mouth. So he was showing his age, he was showing his bruises, and he was sadly showing his desperation towards the end. And prior to the days leading up to his death, he had multiple really, it looked almost like lazy efforts at trying to catch. They were just didn't look like he was, just didn't look like he was going to have any success at all. He was like, sadly, he was always spooking the ibex and spooking the blue sheep way before, and he was just getting desperate, ultimately culminating in that kind of blood-curdling moment when he does successfully get his hands on an ibex. But ultimately, as you see in the film, they tumble together off the side of a near 500-foot vertical drop all the way to the bottom of the valley. And it was heartbreaking to witness this unfolding in front of us with an animal that was just so loved by the locals, and they were all in tears after, which was really heartbreaking to see that they'd obviously fallen in love with this animal over the years that they'd known it. And they were all heartbroken, like as if the world had come to an end. It's that they'd lost their male. But I think they were lucky enough to see that the mother with the three cubs was the future, and the future of the valley. So it was a nice handover in the story itself, and a nice handover in for the territory to be inherited by the three cubs that the mother had so successfully brought up.
I am so conflicted about this. My emotions are all over the place. Like when I watched it and I saw that scene, I saw them lying at the bottom of the valley, and it was just absolute heartbreak. And I can't believe that we got to see that, and can't believe that, yeah, it's one animal. I can't believe, yeah, that you, like, it was so well known, so well followed. But then I absolutely love that you managed to get those last moments, that what we're seeing on the screen is absolutely genuine. And that, I don't know if I can watch it again, knowing now what I know and knowing how upset everyone was. And I guess for a documentary producer, you are all going to be so happy that you have that shot, that you got the last moments, that you got this story, that you get to share it with everyone. So how does it work for you in conflicting emotions, that you got this amazing shot, but then you've seen this absolute tragic death and shared in the mourning of it with the people who cared most for it?
Well, yeah, it was obviously conflicting. And ultimately, we were there to tell the story of mammals taking to the extreme altitudes and extreme environments and conquering the mountains. And it would be a lie to portray that as an easy ride for the snow leopards. It really isn't. I mean, they're evolved to live in that environment, but ultimately it's a daily grind for them. Every single thing they do in those mountains is a risk. So seeing your main character die in that way, ultimately it was was a culmination of a story of like how hard it is to be to for animals to exist in these environments. So for me, it was, it rounded off the story brilliantly, but it's just heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking to know that this animal has died. But yeah, I'm in the same boat, and I'll probably be in the same boat as all the viewers. You can't celebrate that in any way, shape or form. But it tells the story greater than anything we could have wished. These animals go to extraordinary lengths, have evolved extraordinary adaptations to live in one of the riskiest, craziest, harshest environments on the planet. So yeah, heartbreaking, totally. And and watching the local guides suffer, they mourned the loss of this animal as if it was a member of the family, and I think for them it was a member of the family. They'd embraced snow leopards as part of life for them in the mountains, and it was a member of their community that was lost. So yeah, it was a really tough thing to witness. But it was even crazy capturing that. I mean, stories like this always happen on every shoot, but that was the 35th day of shooting, the very last morning where we weren't even going to film. So we had all those multiple cases that need to be packed up and sent back, ready to go back on the journey the following day. So we'd allocated a whole day to packing. But then we woke up that morning and the weather was nice, and we just said, oh, well, John, I can start packing. So I'm the director on location. So you go out with the guides. If they spot anything, let's just give it a go. Last morning, you don't know what might happen. And it's no word of a lie that on that very last morning, John went down. The guide spotted the cat immediately. The male was there. And by the time John had just about got his tripod leveled and hit the red button, I mean, there's a couple of seconds prior to that final shot that are extremely wobbly. I think we cut them out because they were just unusable, but that was the reality of it. It took place in a fraction, and we only got two shots that day. I think three, maybe two or three. It was, but basically within a fraction of time, John was able to set up his camera, press the red button on the camera, and rolled on those final moments as the snow leopard made this last ditch effort for a kill. And yeah, it was the final morning of the filming. And then, yeah, unfolded as you see, and we're able to get that sad, devastating image of the pair of them lay in the bottom of the valley, which I think just hits home the story of the tough life for a snow leopard and the lengths they've gone to survive in these environments.
Oh, this is a lot more emotional of an interview than I thought we were going to have. I don't know if I want to know this. Did the snow leopard have a name?
We didn't give it one, and I don't think it did have a name. I know that others had been following it, and there's actually, I think there's an article written about this snow leopard. I think another photographer had been following it, but we didn't give the snow leopard a name, and I'm glad because I think that would have made it. He was just the old male to us. I think that's it. He was the old male who we kind of fell in love with because he was just a bit, he was charismatic, beaten and battered, but had obviously been really successful because he'd spent 10 years in these mountains, and he's basically left three cubs of his own. And he's just amazing. He was a great, great snow leopard, and he's just the old male to us. And I liked calling him that.
Yeah. So back in Bristol, a couple of years later now, how are you feeling about the scene and about the episode in general? Are you happy that you managed to get this into the documentary?
Yeah, I think I'm very proud of of what we achieved, they're not an easy animal to film. And you, there's things you hope for when you go and film wildlife. One, that you get the most spectacular shots. The other being that you get the most amazing behavior. And I think we managed to get both, but I think the behavior ultimately trumps anything. We got to follow one individual, a true, genuine story. And I think that's the magic of this sequence, that we're telling an account of a very special snow leopard.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for, I guess, getting those last moments. And thank you so much for sharing these extra insights with us. I can't believe how much this discussion has added to that scene for me. Are you sad that you didn't manage to get more of like what we've just discussed into the scene? I know you're completely limited for time and what you can show and what you can tell, but this story is so much bigger than what we saw.
Yeah, there's definitely a bigger story there to be told. I mean, and there's almost things for the future. I mean, I'd love to go and follow them. Nobody knows really, or nobody ever sees them in the summer. Obviously, they get driven down in the winter onto these mountainsides because that's where the prey will go. There's a whole story about these guys. There's extra that we captured whilst we're out there that we have to whittle down to this smaller story. But there's such an amazing, amazing animal living the most extraordinary life. You just want to follow more and learn more about them, because every day is a total drama in the life of a snow leopard. It was just such a pleasure to be able just to bring a segment of that to the audiences. And I think they'll really hopefully enjoy it. And anyone who spends a day this winter out in the cold should have just a little bit more respect for how hard it is for a snow leopard living up in the minus 35 up in the Himalayas.
Right. Well, we're going to leave it on a somber note, and hopefully our review of episode 8, where we deal with the potential sixth mass extinction and the loss of the majority of life on Earth, will be a lot more jolly in episode. So thank you for talking us through everything, Darren.
No problem at all. There's nothing like a sixth mass extinction to bring the joy back to the conversation. Well, let's hope we avert that one. Still time.